Good morning. We're going to get started. Good morning. Since this is our first public meeting of the day, I'd like to turn the floor over to our acting Chief Safety Officer, Lou Brown, for our safety announcement.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. First off, let me alert you if there is an emergency or the fire alarm goes off. Please exit through the doorway that you came in or either of these two doors to my right. We will go safely across the street using the crosswalk and meet at the building museum. Also, in the event that we have a medical emergency needing an AED, there is one located out by the guard shack. This morning's safety contact is bus and metro access customer safety. As a result of customer comments during a recent bus safety initiative, Bus and Metro Access Safety partnered with Marketing, Operations Performance, and Bus to conduct a customer survey concentrating on safety outreach. The survey of Metro bus riders was designed to address several key objectives: to better understand what the main day-to-day safety concern of our bus customers are while riding Metro bus, gauge how effectively our bus safety outreach efforts were, and learn from our current efforts to make recommendations for future safety outreach. Customer recognition was sampled for the following safety messages. 1, always hold on to handrails in case of a sudden stop. 2, make room for fellow passengers. 3, keep a safe distance from the curb as the bus pulls up. 4, stand behind the white line. 5, watch your step when getting on or off the bus. 6, never cross the street in front of a bus. 7, watch your children at all times. And 8, never lean against bus doors. We called this a successful outreach. The awareness of the outreach was very high. Areas of improvement, though: although majority of bus customers reported general recognition of bus safety messaging, their familiarity with particular messages was relatively low. Some safety tips were much more recognized than others. However, with keep a safe distance from the curb and watch your children only being recognized by about 3% of the respondents overall. Future project, partnering with our WMATA colleagues, we're exploring better, improved ways to carry the message of bus safety to customers. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. I'd like to now move approval of the agenda. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. I'd like to move approval of the minutes from the December 3rd meeting. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. I'm sorry?
Abstain.
Abstain. And there are two abstentions. Okay, before I continue, I'd like to recognize we have two new board members, Paul Smedberg and Christian Dorsey. Paul is from Alexandria. And Christian is from Arlington. Both are city council members, so I have a kinship with both of you, as with many other people who are elected officials here. They're both joining the board as alternate members from Virginia, so we'd like to welcome both of you today. Thank you for being here. I'd like to give a brief overview of our agenda today. First, Chief Counsel Poll will provide an overview of proposed revisions to Metro's third-party claims reserve fund. This proposed action will provide staff with greater clarity concerning the use and administration of the fund. Next, the committee will be asked to authorize a public hearing on Metro's FY 2017-2022 capital improvement plan. This hearing is required by the Federal Transit Administration as part of its grants program. Then the Assistant General Manager of Transit Infrastructure and Engineering Services, Andy Off, will review Metro's capital program progress since 2011. This discussion will provide an overview of the projects that have been completed and provide a foundation to help the board's discussion about the next capital funding agreement. Finally, at the request of the board, our CFO will lead a budget workshop to address board members' questions and requests from previous meetings, as well as discuss the status of the renewal of Metro's capital funding agreement. My personal situation is I can stay until 12 noon, and then I have to leave somewhere in that vicinity, at which case the chairman, Mort Downey, will take over at that point, if we're still doing this. So I'd like to turn the floor over now to Mr. Paul to begin our discussions. Mr. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Today, I'm requesting the consolidation and improvement of five existing board resolutions regarding the funding and use of the third-party claims reserve, so that they will end up in one comprehensive policy. The Office of General Counsel and the Office of Risk Management respond to claims on a daily basis for both real or perceived damages and injuries. These claims can arise out of WMATA operations, injuries to patrons or employees, enforcement of WMATA policies, or the failure of WMATA to take appropriate action. WMATA pays valid claims and courtroom judgments out of the third-party claims reserve. This funding line in the budget ensures that cash is available to pay claims when they are due. In order to control the costs of these claims, WMATA purchases insurance to cover large unexpected losses. However, all of our insurance products cover claims only after WMATA has paid an initial amount on the claim. This payment is called the self-insured retention and can run anywhere from $1,000 to $10 million, depending on the policy. In addition, funding for costs of litigation are currently budgeted in the Office of General Counsel's on-call legal services and professional and technical services budget lines. In the context of some pending litigation, I had the opportunity to review the eligible uses of the third-party claims reserve against a rather complex set of facts, large outside counsel expenses, and the applicable insurance coverage. And in conducting this review, I found that the existing policies authorize some but not all of the expenses, as well as some but not all of the potential payments on any judgment, all within the same matter. We have insurance coverage for outside counsel fees, but we cannot use the third-party claims reserve to fund the self-insured retention on that insurance coverage. We have authorization to use the reserve to pay for any judgment in favor of a WMATA employee, but not for judgments in favor of non-employees resulting from the same matter. This is something which, you know, raises many questions in terms both in terms of budgeting, accounting for the true costs of claims, and it is simply is really an unworkable situation. The purpose of the resolution before you is to clean up these disconnects and allow the reserve to be a one source of funding for all WMATA claims outside of procurement. And I exclude procurement because those claims are handled through the capital budget as well as through what we call the Change Control Board, as well as funding, which is, you know, in many cases is partially federal funding, which has to then go through the actual project. So there's no reason to apply procurement matters to the third-party claims reserve. By closing the gaps in the usage of the reserve, we will have better data to cover the full cost of claims. It also allows for everyone to analyze, you know, particularly at risk management, to analyze costs as well as, you know, measuring those against proposed fixes for some of those problems. It's important to note that the proposed changes do not affect the board's current policy regarding the funding of a 20% contingency for the reserve, and that's necessary simply because the funding is developed on an actuarial basis. So we cannot say for sure in any given year what amounts will be used, so the contingency covers that. And I would request adoption of the proposed resolution and be pleased to answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes.
So just briefly, has there been any analysis of what this disparate patchwork of policies has cost WMATA over the years? Has it resulted in any real net impact?
Actually, it's a difficult situation to analyze because of the splits. The odds are, again, I'll say the odds are that it hasn't had any actual impact in cost because, for example, when we take legal fees, right now that comes out of the budget line for on-call legal services. We would be moving some of that into the third-party claims reserve so that one line should go up, one line should go down. But the biggest problem with the current arrangement is just the question that you've raised. I can't answer that one because we would have to literally pull multiple lines from multiple years. The bigger risk actually is in terms of the expenses.
where we might need experts, or we might need, you know, like an e-discovery expert. Right now, some of that would come out of a line in the Office of General Counsel. Other parts of it, depending on the type of case, might come third-party reserve. And so a third source might be having to go to the budget office for a separate allocation. We are hopeful that this arrangement that we're proposing will solve that, make it at least more transparent.
Okay, further questions, comments? Did you say you had a resolution?
Yes, there's a resolution that should be attached to your package.
All right.
It's titled Claims Liability Fund.
Okay. And you want us to adopt it today?
Well, I would request that the committee recommend it for full board adoption.
Okay. All right, so I'd like to move the resolution for, what would you say?
Recommend it to the board.
Recommend to the full board. Is there a second?
Second.
Second. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the ayes have it. Thank you very much. Okay, next, our CFO is going to discuss a public hearing for WMATA Capital Improvement Plan. Dennis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This agenda item today seeks authorization for staff to conduct a public hearing on the proposed FY17 to FY22 Capital Improvement Program. As the board is aware, federal guidelines require public hearing on projects funded by federal grants. So to meet this requirement, staff is requesting this authorization for public hearing as part of our next budget, capital budget cycle. For FY17, for FY17, Metro plans to invest $1.3 billion on system safety, system reliability, and state of good repairs to help ensure quality service for customers. FTA formula funds, as well as FTA non-formula funds, provide critical funding for Metro's capital program. And as a grant recipient, Metro is required to offer the public an opportunity to comment on the projects that will be funded by federal funds. So as part of the public hearing process, Metro will solicit comments and participate, as well as public participation through a variety of outlets, including contacts with jurisdictional partners. The public hearing will be advertised in late January, with public comments beginning in early February. And at this time, staff anticipates that the public hearing will hold during the week of February 22nd. Finally, Mr. Chairman, a public hearing is not required for other aspects of the budget, since the budget as proposed does not increase fares or reduce service. However, staff will conduct public outreach on the proposed budget, which includes new passes, as well as the elimination of the smart trip loading on Metro bus, along with a Title VI analysis and report the findings to this board. Following those outreach and the public comments period, staff will consolidate comments received and report again to the board. With that, staff recommends approval of the request to allow staff to hold a public hearing with respect to the FY17 to 22 FY CIP budget.
Okay, thank you, Dennis. Are there any questions? Yes.
I know that we do not have to conduct a public hearing on the other parts of the budget, but I guess the question is, would it be advisable to include some other parts of the budget in the public hearing? I say that for a couple of reasons. One is that in the past we have used the public hearing as sort of a way to inform the public about the overall impact of the budget, and it might be, I understand that there's other ways that we're going to get out to people on the other aspects of the budget, but it seems to me this might be another outreach opportunity to let people know. And it also might be a little odd for people coming to a budget public hearing to just hear about the capital budget, not the operating budget. The other reason I ask is specifically because of the the smart trip loading on bus. I know we've discussed that, but I do remember there has been some concern by some board members about eliminating the loading on the bus. And I understand, I see in the materials that you sent us, you said that there is, it's not an either or, there's a middle ground there that we might possibly do. But I wonder if our decision might be informed by public comment on that proposal.
If I could, I agree. I mean, we will present both the capital and the operating. I mean, to me, it's the budget. So I think both, I know both will be discussed at the public hearing.
I don't think we can ever be too inclusive. You know, so I agree with you. Further questions?
Oh, Norton? I'm sorry. Yeah. May I just clarify your comment? Would you also be specifically talking about the loading the smart trip on the bus? Would that also be part of the public hearing?
Yeah, any element of the budget, operating or capital, we'll be talking about.
Okay.
On the capital side, we are going forward with the program as proposed in the CEO's budget, but that doesn't preclude us from making changes at a later time. This isn't giving approval to the budget. It's giving approval to holding hearings on the budget.
That's correct.
Okay, here and then go ahead. Tom, and then Milk. Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to point out that I'm glad to see on Attachment A that staff incorporated the new five-year federal transportation apportionments for the next fiscal year that the President signed in December. And it is an increase. It's not great. It's like 8% on the formula funds, but it's better than the alternative. And going forward, there's other growth in the FAST Act, it's called, for in the four fiscal years to after next one. I noticed in Attachment A, though, that we're still not identifying some of the discretionary grant opportunities that are involved in the new five-year federal transportation bill. Is that something that we will be able to chew on in the future?
We are aware there are additional opportunities with respect to competitive grants, and we expect to fully explore those going forward, consistent with both the direction that you've provided and the guidance that this board has given us in the past.
Well, I'll just mention one, State of Good Repair is in the new legislation, was in the old one, and it's now in the new one. And I would hope that we would take a hard look at those kind of grant activities that are being provided under the new federal law.
That is the goal.
Well, in the past, we've got PREAS, so we don't do the other thing. So I don't know how we want to strategically present ourselves on that that option. So let us know.
Okay. Thank you.
Malcolm?
I'm assuming that the public hearing is going to be here. I just want clarification on, you know, just that it's going to be here, it'll be at night, or how are you going to make it as accessible as possible for the public?
Last year it was held at this location. We expect it will be at this location. Those details are being finalized, and they will be broadly advertised to our customers using all of the medium available to us. But that's...
Okay. And in the evening, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Further? No. Okay. All right. I'd like to move the authorization for public hearing on the FY 2017 to 2022 capital improvement program. Is there a second?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Can I just ask one question before
sure.
we vote on this? The comprehensive funding agreement is that assumed to be 1 year? It's not really clear to me.
That's correct. And we will get into a little bit more detail, but yes, it will be 1 year in the interim, but normally it's for a 6-year timeline. And so the goal will be to ultimately get to a 6-year, but for now we're looking for a 1-year extension.
And then if it is 1 year, we assume there will likely be increases? After that 1 year period?
That 1 year will reflect the FY17 capital program, and the next 6 years CFA should reflect the next 6 years capital cycle, which may or may not include increases depending on what this board approves and what the system needs to turn out to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, anything further? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Thank you. Thank you, Dennis. Let's see. Next, Mr. Off will review Metro's capital program progress since FY 2001.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Andy Off, Transit Infrastructure Engineering Services, and this morning I will be providing a macro-level overview of our FY 11 through FY 15 capital program. First, we'll watch a video in which I will have my eyes closed. Thank you.
Where is the video? Video.
In fiscal year 11, WMATA began executing a very aggressive capital program of almost $5 billion. Of that, almost $1 billion has been spent on a rolling stock. New buses, bus rehabilitations, rail car rehabilitations, and replacing our metro access. We've also invested... Of that, almost $1 billion has been spent on a rolling stock. New buses, bus rehabilitations, rail car rehabilitations, and replacing our metro access. We've also invested almost $335 million in our track rehabilitation program, renewing rails, cross ties, and fasteners. This is 115-pound running rail that was delivered to our Greenbelt facility that we will use to replace old rail in the system. We've renewed approximately 64 linear miles of running rail, which is what we see here. It's delivered to our Greenbelt production facility in 78-foot-long sticks, and it's here where we welded into 390-foot long stringers and put that in the system. This is a wood cross tie. We've replaced approximately 83,000 wood cross ties in the system, which is about 25% of our total inventory. The tie plates, which secure the rail, are fastened to the wood cross tie, and that's what holds the gauge. Here we have a guarded number 8 switch with the two switch rails, the two stock rails, and based upon the alignment of these switch rails, will dictate whether the train makes a straight through move or makes a turning move. As an effect of a NTSB recommendation, we've replaced over 176 switches or number 8 guarded turnouts throughout the system. We have also invested $145 million in updating our track maintenance equipment, that equipment used to rehabilitate the track infrastructure, and also to maintain our rail car vehicle fleet. Examples being very unique, one-of-a-kind piece of equipment, a 330-foot-long ballast vacuum, which sucks the old rock out of the system, and then we come in behind that, and we can install new ballast to make sure that we have a good, firm foundation for which to secure our running rails.
This is our 7,000 series commissioning facility where we will commission all 748 rail cars to be delivered.
The biggest improvement is just the lighting, how bright it is. It feels much more welcoming. There is no doubt that this will become our most reliable series in the fleet.
From fiscal year 2011 through fiscal year 2015, in support of our aggressive vertical transportation program, we have rehabilitated 148 escalators, replaced 27 escalators, and rehabilitated 44 elevators. We've replaced kiosks, replaced station ceiling tile, have installed new stairs, have
fixed station platforms and installed new tactile warning devices. The Shady Grove Metro Station platform was cracked, deteriorated. That program renewed the entire station platform service. We should be done with Minnesota Avenue station platform in early spring of 2016. We have also invested $88 million into facilities which will deliver a safer and more secure transit environment, to include our Special Operations Division facility and our District 2 Police Substation, which was dedicated in December of 2014 to our first officer lost in the line of duty, Mr. Harry Davis Jr. Much has been accomplished between fiscal year 11 and fiscal year 15. However, much more needs to be done.
Okay, and continuing with the briefing, just to set the framework, in September of 2008, an inventory was conducted of capital assets. In 2009, those assets were prioritized. In December of 2009, the budget was presented. And then in June of 2010, the budget was approved prior to adoption, prior to beginning fiscal year 11 the following month. The primary goals of the CFA included NTSB recommendations from the 2009 Fort Todd tragedy, and over the six-year CIP, Metro planned to replace all the 1,000 series rail cars and approximately 100 buses per year. A significant investment was also planned for rail lines and stations during this time. Here's a side-by-side comparison of those goals which were outlined in the CFA compared to what we actually delivered. For our rolling stock, just as one example, we had planned on delivering 100 buses per year. Through FY15, we have averaged approximately 96 buses per year. Across the rolling stock fleet, fairly stable with the exception of the 7K contract, which I believe we're all aware of the delays involved there. And certainly, you know, the contract was executed on time, but certainly the tsunami and then follow-on quality control and commissioning processes, have exacerbated some of those delays. In our track and structures program, certainly our most successful side-by-side comparison. We certainly exceeded those goals as outlined in the CFA in some cases, almost doubling those goals. In particular, you can see fasteners where we planned 15,000 and averaged 28,000 a year. Station improvements, primarily executed under our Orange Blue Line 1 rehabilitation contract and our Red Line 1 rehabilitation contract, where we focus primarily on stations, kiosks, ceiling tiles, stairs, and also major deep cleanings in an aesthetic like-new condition for 120 of our stations, 60 minors and 60 majors. Some were done more than once over the course of the five-year period. Vertical transportation, as noted in the video, 44 rehabilitations, 148 rehabilitations for escalators, and 27 replacements for escalators. Next. Facility improvements. The Greenbelt test track, the commissioning facility, is complete. We expect to be done with the track no later than March. We've also rehabilitated a lot of rail car equipment, maintenance equipment in our yard facilities, and also rehabilitated three bus garages. Next. NTSB recommendations. We have closed 25 of 29. There are four remaining, replacement of the 1K certainly being one, the removal of all the Generation 2 track circuits being the second, which we plan to be done with this calendar year, installing event recorders and vehicle monitoring systems on all of our rail cars, which we are also well underway, and then the last being a two-way wayside worker warning system, which we continue to work on with our federal partners. In total, from FY11 through FY15, we have invested $3.7 billion of the $5 billion outlined in the CFA. Next. Of course, goes without saying, we certainly had our challenges in meeting our budgeted investments. Here you can see by percentage the amount of money that was approved by the board for that respective fiscal year. And, you know, obviously last year being our worst, you know, performing year, where we only invested 65% of those funds that were planned to be invested for FY15. Principal reasons for understanding, we obviously have spent a lot of time looking intrinsically to determine, you know, what are our flaws and why did this happen. Certainly, you know, management controls, you know, a capital program of this magnitude requires, you know, very intense, you know, initiation processes, scope development processes, what goes forward, what doesn't go forward, ensuring we don't make commitments that we simply can't support. So going forward, there will certainly be, you know, changes to those processes under Mr. Wiedefeld's leadership. Contract delays, whether those be permitting challenges, delays with manufacturers, as evidenced in our bus replacement contract, where the contract was awarded, the winning bidder was bought out by a competitor, and certainly that, you know, causes some logistical problems in executing the work. Schedule delays, changing priorities, an example certainly has been noted, the September 2009 tragedy at Fort Totten. The red line contract that was noted in the CFA was awarded the same month. Certainly prior to Fort Totten, it was the priority for work on the red line, obviously, and rightfully so, was not after. Next. Lessons learned, certainly ensuring we present, you know, a budget that is executable. We have good history over the past 5 years. We know which projects historically perform well. We understand those projects where there is variable, you know, scope development issues. We basically can put those into two different categories, you know, of high confidence and low confidence. Focusing on deliverables, holding our project managers accountable, not for expenses, but for a plan and executing to that plan. Improving our forecasting techniques, certainly to be able to speak intelligently about where we're going, we have to know where we're at. It requires, you know, a weekly, daily, you know, due diligence on ensuring we understand where we're at so we can accurately forecast. Of course, awarding smaller, more narrowly focused contracts, $330 million firm fixed price contracts and an operating railroad are not easy things to change. Things change on our system, and thus we're more focused on putting in place vehicles that allow us to react to situations in the system. Next steps, you know, we'll be, you know, continuing to prepare and refine the capital budget, hopefully presenting for approval in April, and then beginning to execute FY17 in July. That concludes. Any questions?
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions, comments? Yes, Tom.
Thanks for the update. Can we go to the slide that has the capital improvement invested over the fiscal 2011 to 2015, where the histogram shows the unspent amounts from 2011 to 2015. So of these amounts, starting with 29%, and then last year's terrible result of 35% unspent, how much of that is federal funds that have a life, a shelf life, that we have to worry about in terms of losing?
Thank you, Mr. Bulger. I think on a order of magnitude basis, somewhere between 50 and 60% of the unspent balance is going to be federal. FTA grants. For clarity, most of our FTA grants do not have an explicit expiration date. There are, once the grants are awarded, there are projected spend downs, typically over the course of a couple of years.
Right.
To the extent that a grant is near fully spent or close to fully spent, there are procedures with FTA to bring those to closure, but generally the funds are available until spent.
Okay. All right. Second question, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind. I'd like to go to the slide that talks, the next two slides after that, I think it is, about maybe it's stream. I'll find it and say it has to do with streamlining. There it is. Streamlined track access procedures. Okay. We discussed months ago, and Rob, we've had these conversations about getting more track access to do bigger projects like considering closing Station X and Station Y and just going in and doing a big time, big bang job. Is that something, and you wanted to wait till Paul got here, is that what that means, streamline track access, or are we talking about the same stuff we've been doing since 2011?
If I could, that's exactly what we're talking about. So I'm doing a review of that whole process, okay. The prioritization process that we use in basically using track time, and are there other ways we should be doing it?
So when do you think the board will get another refreshed view of how we get better track access to?
We'll get it to you as quickly as I get it.
Okay, let's be sure we can have that conversation. Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Let me get a list here. Mike Mort, who else? Mike Mort, who else? Tony, Malcolm. Did I miss anybody here? Okay, Mike.
Mr. Hoff, I want to ask you a few questions on the Red Line Rehabilitation Project. As you described that, this is mainly a project that dealt with rehabilitation of the platforms, kiosks, and associated things like that, the HVAC systems. Am I correct about that?
Yes, sir, that is correct.
And at this point, this project is now completed, the Red Line Rehabilitation?
Yes, sir, that project is complete.
Okay, so 100%, or is there a stage two? Since this was referred to as stage one, is there a stage two?
Sir, there is a stage two in the program. It was not referenced in this briefing as it was not, not part of history. But that will be discussed as part of the FY17 budget that
so
will be
what
presented.
My question is, what was done in stage one, and what remains to be done in stage two?
Sir, it was basically territory. So phase one went from, and I don't want to misspeak, so went from station X to station Y. And then Red Line 2 was intended to go, from station A to station B. So essentially under Red Line 2, we'd be focused, between DuPont and Shady Grove, primarily focusing in the Grosvenor and Bethesda area.
I'm sorry, so is that by example, or are you saying that is what stage 2 will be, going from DuPont out to Shady Grove?
Sir, that is the current plan.
Right. Now, the rehabilitation project did not deal with the replacement of tracks, ties, and insulators, and those projects. Am I correct about that?
Yes, sir, absolutely. We execute all of our track, rail, ties, fastener work using our force account. The rehabilitation contracts, as you noted, were primarily station amenities, traction power work, whether that be our AC rooms in the stations or traction power systems that feed the railroad.
So what I'm trying to get at is, while you've rehabilitated the platforms and the kiosks, how much of the actual third rails and rails replacement has been done on the Red Line? I guess where I'm coming from is Red Line riders seem to think that the Red Line gets an inordinate amount of delay, and that this is a result of the Red Line being the legacy line, the oldest line in the system. So I'm trying to get to the point where I understand how much more has to be done to make the Red Line almost new again, to eliminate the delays.
Yes, sir. The list of work, will never end. Obviously, a significant amount of work, has been done on the Red Line in the past 4 years. I can tell you we've been single tracking a lot during the day, just as of late, renewing third rail and insulators, up in the area of Bethesda. I can't specifically answer your question, but I certainly have the information available, to do that, just not present.
Right. If you can follow up with a note to myself and other board members of how much has been done on the Red Line and what's the percentage of work in terms of replacing rails, ties, third rails, and insulators and that kind of system that still needs to be done.
Absolutely.
On the Red Line to bring it up to snuff.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Now, my comment is somewhat along the same lines. As we've been at this capital program now for 6 years, this is really the first time I've seen a good presentation that said, what was it we were intending to do, and have we done it? The charts that are in here were very refreshing, that we were to do so many miles of rail, we've actually exceeded that. I think there is a flaw in the way we have been monitoring and measuring the progress. And I understand this capital funding agreement was focused on expenditures because the jurisdictions, rightly so, want to know when will they need to put up the money. And we're very happy that they do, and we're happy to let them know when we need it. But this is not necessarily the best way to measure how effective we are in moving forward. I would hope as we go to a new CFA and a new focus, we begin to get milestones of how much have we obligated, how much of real work that needs to be done have we completed. Really look at all aspects of scope, schedule, and budget, and not just at the end of the day, have we spent the money? That's what the chart up there has said. We did not actually expend the money. And that's maybe a measure that we haven't gotten the work done, or maybe it's a measure that the work is underway, but we really have not gotten to the stage of the project where it's being spent. I just think we need a much better handle at getting on this. And, you know, as a mature capital program, we should have all that information for your own use and controlling, but I think it can also be better presented to the board and to the public on how their funds are being spent. So great first step in really looking at that. A lot more needing to be done as we move into a new CFA.
Did you have something, Paul?
Just want to comment. I agree, and I have started internal, in effect, like a CompStat process on the capital program, where I meet weekly now.
Might want to sit in. That's a fly on the wall for one of those meetings.
At the project manager level. So, again, it's just not all being rolled up, but so I can physically, where we physically on completion of the project, and then, yes, there's the dollar side of it at the same time, but, you know, again, the goal here is to deliver a project and not necessarily to spend the dollars. So if we spend too much time focusing on that, we lose sight of what we're delivering.
I mean, one of the other goals has been to renew the system to a state of good repair, which we certainly are doing. Conversations over the last several years have made the point we're in a catch-up mode. We had to do in 5 years what we should have done over 10, but we're all anxious to know when does that catch-up mode reach its termination and when do we go to the what it needs to be done every year. And as Andrew said, it never ends, but we don't always have to be catching up with the past if we've reached kind of a steady state of renewal.
Okay. Tony, Malcolm, Jim. Tony.
Thanks for the report. I was happy to see the first bullet, principal reasons for underspending management controls. I think you both talked about introducing more and more management controls. I guess my question is, are we benchmarking other organizations? Because we're not unique in what we do. And if you had to, who are you looking at as a benchmarking target? And if you had your druthers, whose system would you adopt tomorrow if you could?
Sir, we network a lot, you know, with other transits, and through feedback from consultants, we know that historically expending all of, you know, a transit authority's agency's capital budget is a challenge. There certainly are very good industry best practice models that we are well aware of. I grew up in the Corps of Engineers, which has, you know, fairly disciplined, you know, project management practices, not necessarily applicable, you know, in totality here. I spent a lot of time out at CTA that they have, you know, they take a different approach to a lot of work they do, but they certainly have, you know, there's a lot of visibility, a lot of discussions with senior leadership about movement of funds, you know, from one project to the other. That's one example that I'm aware of. We are well aware that there are better things out there. As Mr. Wiedefeld stated, we've already had our first, and it was very refreshing. We're getting the right people involved, asking the tough questions, and I think we're going to get better.
But if you could solve something tomorrow, what would be, in your mind, the most important thing to solve?
Sir, you know, from my perspective, certainly, to me, we have to be more disciplined in the way we start a project. Is it scoped? Is it defined? Are we comfortable making a commitment? Can I go to the general manager and tell him I'm confident that this is a commitment we can share publicly and put taxpayer money against it to execute. I think that is where it starts. We're good at executing.
Right, I agree. I mean, the thing that I see is the needs inventory hasn't been updated in years. That should be the first step. And then after that, there should be some sort of development evaluation program before we make commitments. So then when we make the commitment, we know what we're committing to. So we just don't put something out there. And then we have to try to work to that number or work to that project that just hasn't been, you know, fully developed. It's not, you know, in all projects meet that, but there are certain projects here that, you know, we jumped to a level or to a commitment that we just didn't, in my estimation, we just didn't have the we just didn't know enough about to do that, and that's some of what you're seeing here when you see some of these delays and projects not being delivered.
So it's assessing risk and managing that risk of the life of the project.
To me, it's the detailed planning, design, you know, project engineering before you commit to construction. And so I think sometimes we skip that step.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mine was just along the same lines, and just the hope that we would also measure the efficiency of the money that is spent that you set out initially. You know, this is the project, this is the scope, this is what was spent. That's not in this presentation, like you said. We're really more so looking at, just piggybacking on what Mr. Downey said, we're really looking at what was spent. It does not yet share information about, let's say, cost overruns, things that may have occurred, and how efficiently we've been able to spend that money. I'm hopeful that we'll get a chance to see that kind of information so that we can then make sure that we are doing what you talked about, which is, you know, spending this money efficiently, because I am concerned that what we're looking at now, we cannot assess that. We can't really tell how we are doing in that regard.
Okay, thanks, Jim.
So this is continuing that same conversation of Mr. Augustine. It's to really look at the principal reasons for underspending that you outline and really figuring out what part of the annual underspending is attributable to each of those factors so that we can provide a governance role of figuring out how to evaluate what systems you change and how you apply the lessons learned. All useful information, glad that you're sharing the narrative, but looking at each piece and saying, okay, this is because of management issues, or this is because of changing priorities, and this is how it tracks over time, for me, would provide a really useful way to be able to provide some real governance as opposed to just speculating.
And sir, we have done that analysis, and we can definitely share that with you.
That would be great.
Yes, sir. Okay. Jim?
Thank you. Andrew, great first step with this analysis, and you look good on film as well. In many of the analysis you had what our goal was and what our accomplishments were. That was not up there with the elevators and escalators piece.
Yes, sir.
Could you take a look at that and let us and the public know how did we compare to what the original plan was on those? Because I think and maybe on the next page, too, with the facility improvements, it has a little bit of a descriptor there, but this one here was kind of left hanging out.
Yes, sir, and that was a challenge that we shared. We researched the CFA. That unfortunately, there was not a comparative metric. In other words, red line rehabilitation, was somewhat vague. It said rehabilitate the red line. There weren't, you know, specific deliverables, and the same was true on our vertical transportation programs. Fortunately, you know, for track and structures and our rolling stock assets, we were able to provide a good comparative analysis. So we didn't have the apple.
So in your professional opinion, how did we do?
Sir, I think
on this particular area. This is one that we hear constantly from the public that, oh, darn.
Yes, sir.
They usually use different words, but escalators are not working again.
Yes, sir. And you know, statistics are just they're just numbers. But, you know, our measures, you know, have shown that we've moved, you know, from about 87% to about 92%, you know, availability on escalators during the execution of this capital program. So I think there's certainly, you know, evidence to suggest that this investment has improved service. So we are confident saying that. However, we're still, you know, trying to improve ways we communicate on elevator and escalator outages because our feedback is we're not doing good enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Anything further? Yes, Kathy.
just following up on that, because I think that that was an underlying piece in us talking about this capital budget, and that Mr. Downey talked about the state of good repair. The ability to get to a state of good repair is a continuous rolling piece, and I think this slide is a very good one to look at, because we know how difficult our escalator, elevator repair and maintenance and service that we're giving to our customers has been. But we can't say to our customers, just the milestone we truly have met through the years of this work. And I think some way to ensure that the customers can see that an outage, a delay, or what is in a relatively good state versus simply it's always the same problem. And I think what we hear in our complaints there, it's the same problem, but we've invested a lot, so how do we show them the value of that investment? And messaging, to me, is an important part of that.
And I do think if we go, you know, get more traction on that public message from 87 to 92 performance, that is a real positive.
Or new versus...
I shouldn't say it's a real positive, but it certainly is a positive.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm now going to turn the meeting over to Mr. Downey, and he'll handle the last item.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last item is a follow-up to our December meeting when Mr. Wiedefeld presented for the first time the operating and capital budget proposals. A number of questions were raised, and he and Dennis are here with the follow-up of additional information that we would need before we act on this in the spring.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The agenda for today's work session is threefold. First, we'll briefly recap the FY17 budget proposal, followed by a review of the questions that were raised following the budget presentation. Lastly, we will update the budget and the committee, as has been raised already today, with respect to the CFA, which is needed to support Metro's capital program. So last December, staff presented Metro's proposed FY17 operating, as well as the six-year, $6 billion CIP to this board. To recap, the proposed $1.8 billion operating budget, again, does not increase fares and does not cut service. The budget also keeps the jurisdictional subsidy flat. It does this by reducing administrative costs and by leveraging FTA funds for eligible preventive maintenance programs. On the capital side, the CIP is $1.13 billion, focused on safety and system reliability. Again, the capital program maintains the funding level approved by the board this time last year. As we discussed last year, one aspect of Metro's FY17 operating budget balancing strategy is the increased use of federal funds for FTA-eligible preventive maintenance activities. To put this in context, today Metro pays preventive maintenance expenses from both the operating as well as the capital budgets, with current board policy limiting federal reimbursement for preventive maintenance to $31 million. Which means that most of those preventive maintenance expenses are left in the operating budget. However, as part of FTA's enhanced security oversight, they have encouraged Metro to utilize federal funds for preventive maintenance activities as part of our State of Good Repair initiative. So for FY17, the proposed budget leverages current federal grants and the capacity that we have in the current capital budget to provide our new general manager and this board the opportunity to reset expectation as well as the budget priorities without impacting Metro customers or the jurisdictions. Shifting to the questions for a minute, and as Board Member Borger mentioned a little bit earlier, the recently approved FAST Act reauthorizes key federal programs that fund Metro's capital program. Under that act, as he mentioned this morning, Metro will get $22 million next year. And over the remaining 5 years of the 6 year cycle, Metro expects to get about between 1% and 2% increase every year. In addition, and perhaps equally significant, PREA was reauthorized, which provides $150 million to Metro each year, which will be matched by the jurisdictions. So staff intends to update the capital program, but maintain the same cap with respect to the 6 year timeline, which means that the additional funds will be used to reduce the debt that were embedded in the original capital program submitted to the board. With respect to fares, in November, the board was informed that lowering the peak period maximum rail fare to $5 would generate about 200,000 additional trips each year, but reduce fare revenue by about $6 million a year. The reason for this is that Metro riders making the longest trips have fewer options and therefore are less sensitive to fare adjustment. And a recent analysis by the University of Maryland also found that Metro's peak period long-distance riders have an elasticity that's around negative 0.15%, again confirming the baseline of the information provided to the board, which means that any adjustments at that level will have minimal impact on ridership, but will have a far more significant impact on fares, and therefore on revenues. With respect to onboard smart loading, again, a subject that was discussed a little bit earlier today, Metro customers currently have the ability to load funds on their smart trips on Metro Bus. And while this feature continues to benefit riders, it also impacts passenger boarding process, increases dwell time, and reduces average bus speed. And with bus speed across the region continuing to decline, the proposed budget seeks to reduce operating costs and improve on-time performance by discontinuing this practice. Eliminating smart trip loading, however, will impact some customers, as I indicated, and so we will focus over the next few months on identifying alternatives that will allow our customers to continue to add values to their smart trip cards and allow us to implement this particular program. This slide provides information that the committee requested on Metro Access performance over the last couple of years. And as this slide shows, Metro Access expenses, revenues, and subsidy has grown steadily over the last few years. And the proposed FY17 budget anticipates a continuation of this trend, which is why funding for Metro Access in FY17 will increase to keep pace with this growth. Finally, two clarifications, one on revenues and the other one on expenses. In FY16, Metro used $27 million of one-time non-recurring revenues from transit infrastructure funds to balance the operating budget. This funding is not available in FY17, which is the reason for the variance in the operating budget that was raised as a question last time. And with respect to other expenses, again, which showed the significant variation from FY16, that category now reflects FTA-required changes in the capital program cost allocation methodology. The budget now shows the credit within one cost center instead of being spread across the budget. So turning briefly to the CFA, Metro and the jurisdictions, as I responded a little bit earlier today, are now focused on a one-year extension of the current plan. And just as a reminder, the current CFA expires on June 30th of this year. The one-year extension, again, will include a not-to-exceed jurisdictional capital contribution amount that will be based on the current proposed program, subject to any changes that this board or the GM may make. And Metro has asked the jurisdictions to approve the CFA by March of this year to ensure that any changes made with respect to any program are incorporated in the CIP budget that this board will be considering in April of this year. But following the one-year extension, Metro and the jurisdictions will focus on a six-year CFA, which will then reflect the contents and the results of the CNI that the general manager just spoke about a few minutes ago. Finally, the next few months are expected to be busy, with staff conducting a detailed budget workshop for the JCC, followed by a public hearing on the CIP, as this board, this committee approved earlier today. And then a more detailed capital budget discussion at next month's board session. In March, staff will provide an update of the outreach and public hearing, as well as seek board approval of the debt issuance, which, as you recall, was approved last year. And if that all goes well, the board will approve, consider and hopefully approve the FY17 budget and the CFA extension in April, which will allow us 4 weeks later to submit grant applications well ahead of the FY17 fiscal year. That concludes my presentation, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be glad to respond to any questions.
Thank you. I mean, these were a lot of issues that were raised. I'm sure there will be more as we go along, but we need to work together to get the information we need. Are there questions? Tom, and who else? Jim? Michael?
Chairman, thanks, Dennis, for the report. Can we go to the slide that says FY 2017 proposed budget recap, particularly the last bullet? It's CIP will have, there's three bullets under it. The last bullet includes $1.1 billion of long-term financing. I know we've talked about this peripherally, but Dennis, could you elaborate on what we're thinking about on this $1.1 billion of long-term financing in the CIP, please?
Thank you, Mr. Borgia. As my colleague Tom indicated a little bit earlier today, the entire capital program, the $6 billion capital program, includes federal funds about 50-60%, and the rest are essentially made up of local funds and some system performance funds. Of the local component, some of that, obviously, jurisdictional appropriations, consistent with each jurisdiction's desire or capacity to provide those funds. The difference, and in this timeline, there's a difference of about $1 billion, which will be made up by debt. So the way the process works is that when we get to the point where there's a gap in funding and additional funds are needed, this board will have to vote on the process of debt issuance, and at which point, working with the jurisdictions, we will provide them an opportunity to opt out. To opt out and provide funds directly to Metro at that time instead of issuing debt. But at this point, that $1.1 billion reflects the difference between the total funds that are available and the total funds that are needed for that timeline.
So just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, I think this is a big issue. Obviously, thanks for the answer to this. So when is that all going to happen? Is that going to be in the one-year agreement that we're going to extend, or is that going to be separate?
No, they're not all in the one-year agreement. Okay. The one-year component is it's slightly less than $300 million. And so it's our expectation that for the extension, it will reflect about 300 of the $1 billion, assuming again that this board approves the capital program as currently proposed.
Okay, final question, and I just wanted to make sure for new board members, particularly. So Dennis, what's the outlook on our bond capacity and bond rating, and how are we doing with being able to go to the bond markets if we have to, even though there's an opt-out for the jurisdictions?
If you recall, when the board approved the $220 million debt issuance last year, we were not able to go to the market because of our inability to complete the financials.
Right.
As of December this year, we have not only completed the financials but had a clean opinion.
Right.
which now allows us to go to the capital markets. So the question now is one of timing and one of need. Obviously, you don't want to go to the market until you need those funds. And so as we work with Rob and his team, as well as with the jurisdictions, we will determine what the appropriate time for going to the markets with respect to those funds, which is different from the $220 million, which is intended to repay some of the current lines of credit.
So the lines of credit are back to normal?
Or some
left? The lines of credit, if you recall, Metro had about $500 million of short-term debt.
Right.
We, as of today, we have paid down $300 million of debt. So, yes, we are back to normal, but our goal is to still restructure the capital, our capital structure, to one that does not rely significantly on lines, but preserves those for cash flow optimization if needed.
So you're not going to defease the line of credit, the outstanding $200 million? You're going to
our expectation and our commitment to this board is that we will use the debt issuance to defease a significant portion of the current line, and that's still the goal.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mort. Dennis, thank you for the report. Going back to the slide with the projected increases and in both ridership and cost of the Metro Access results, one of the areas we've been talking about, and perhaps I missed something, was the utilization of private services to provide this at a much more efficient cost and for a better passenger experience. And I see that continuing to increase at a healthy clip. Is this truly what we're projecting for the next year and a half, or are we going to see more utilization of the private services?
We are, as you know, we are engaged with the district as well as with the both state of Maryland and Virginia to look for opportunities to shift service providers with respect to Metro Access. The partnership with DC has been quite successful and has shifted a significant amount of both rides and costs. But proportionally speaking, that's still a relatively small number compared to the overall size. That's why you're seeing continuing growth, even though we continue to make progress. And the goal is to continue to expand alternate delivery strategies, but Metro continues to be the primary service provider, and I think until you see a significant shift, this trend is expected to continue.
Thank you.
Yeah, right. Thank you. I have a few questions for Dennis on the operating budget, but before we're done in the meeting today, I'd also like to move
an authorization. Could we come back to that after we do questions? Yes.
Long-haul fare reduction. Dennis, there's three areas where I'm still trying to get a handle on and get a level of comfort on the operating budget. The first is the preventive maintenance issue. Now, I understand that we've traditionally funded $31 million of the preventive maintenance in the capital budget. And I gather that we've moved some greater amount, some additional amount, from the operating budget to the capital budget for this one-shot budget in 2017. I'm trying to get a handle on how much, in addition to the $31 million, are we moving from the operating budget to the capital budget for 2017?
It's approximately $70 million.
$70 in additional to the $30?
Correct.
So it's a total of now $100 million that will be funded as part of the capital budget.
So it's a net of $70 million.
Okay. And where would that, if we were budgeting this year as we budgeted last year, where would that $70 million be? Would that be in the personnel line?
Some in personnel, some in parts. And some in personnel. Most in personnel, services, and parts. Those are the three primary.
Okay. And that sort of takes me into my second question. In the personnel line, which is simple concepts, $1.3 billion. The number is the same as in the current fiscal year, $1.3 million FY 2016. And I'm trying to understand how that number stays the same from 2016 to 2017 in light of collective bargaining agreement wage increases and in light of the increase of headcount of 59 people. I want to get a level of comfort of how reliable we can make that kind of assertion and stick to it as a budgetary matter.
Okay. So, there's, as you can imagine, there's a series of things going on with the budget, some adds and some puts. Essentially, if you start with the conversation about preventive maintenance, the shift from operating to capital, that takes away a significant portion, and I can get you the breakdown in terms of how much is coming from personnel to preventive maintenance. So that's a reduction from what would have been a growth in terms of personnel. With respect to collective bargaining, when we discussed this in December, we indicated that we had no funds in the department budgets for that exercise. Our expectation is that whatever additional resources will be needed to provide raises or increases to Metro employees will be the result of savings identified in other areas with the goal of keeping that as cost neutral as possible. And to the extent that, you know, that results in additional resources, then we will be coming back to this board for a different set of decisions. With respect to the additional positions that you referred to, those are essentially capital positions designed to address the SMI issues identified by FTA. So those are not within the operating budget. You will be seeing that in the capital budget.
All right. Third question. The budget documents state that there will be a savings of $20 million mm-hmm. resulting from the McKinsey efficiency study. Where are those reflected in the budget? Is that the reduction of $13 million? In the material and supplies account largely, or is that spread across the different expense categories?
It is at this point, which is why we're being transparent, that you know, we expect that to be an outcome of the ongoing activities. Obviously, it's spread across the board in the budget, but that's something that we will be discussing with the board as part of the budget workshops over the next few months.
So it's not particularly identified in any expense category per se right now.
That's correct.
In fact, it hasn't been found yet.
Oh, well, that's why I'm curious where it is.
Right.
My final question is, and this is this other category in the expense budget, and I realize I'm rather thick about this. You know, there's been a reduction of $31 million from last year to this year, and you started to explain it. But I've got to ask you to try and explain it in layman's language. Is this real money that's being saved, or is this accounting changes? You know, is this real dollar savings, or is this just a product of accounting changes?
Okay. So, conceptually speaking, right, when we apply, we use FTA funds for capital projects, there is a reimbursement that goes for overhead, and that comes historically, and that has been a historical allocation in terms of cost allocation. FTA sends their team in here to evaluate those numbers to make sure they're right. Typically, historically, what Metro had done was to, again, spread it across the entire organization. As part of the most recent cost allocation plan that we've discussed with the FTA, it was decided to have that credit in one location. So what you're looking at here is really a presentation issue. That reimbursements were here in the past, but you could not see it because it was spread up again across the organization. Right now, we are putting it in one location again in an attempt to be more transparent so that you can ask questions and we can hopefully provide you with the responses. But this is not new. It has been presented a little differently. Again, consistent with our conversations with FTA.
All right, let me go at it one other way, and then we'll leave it to the JCC experts to try and figure it out. Was the number in the current fiscal year, the $35.4 million, is that a real expense number? Do we actually pay out $35 million for some other category in the current fiscal year 2016? Or is that an accounting number that was put in to compensate for the $3.9 billion in the FY17 budget?
I'm sorry, which $35 million are you referring to?
I'm looking at a budget from the December work papers under the line other that says $35.4 million in the approved FY2016 budget.
And maybe you could, Dennis, could you get us a written memo on that?
Yeah, I'll get you a written response. I'm trying to.
Yeah.
Okay, right. I will suddenly provide a written response.
Thank you.
Sure.
Oh, thank you, Dennis. I just had a question about the fare reduction slide about customers loading their smart trips on buses. Do you have the percentage numbers of the different riders comparing Prince George's County on bus riders and Southeast DC riders versus the rest of the bus systems? Will that be something that we could look at?
It is something that we certainly will look at. It has been raised as an issue, but I do not have the data here with me. But we will certainly look at that and provide that information if we have it to you and to the board.
Thank you.
Yes, Malcolm.
Forgive me for stepping out, but on the same slide, I have real concerns about removing the ability for riders of bus to add money to the Smart Trip card on the bus. Particularly in my neighborhood, there is only one CVS or place where you can actually put money on the card. And they don't even really, it's not the easiest thing to manage. There's really a real hole in the space of someone being able to actually get the card. So there's a couple of things. One, for sure, I would hope that we would look to improve on the network that is available. This goes beyond even just this discussion, but in the fact that we're getting rid of the paper fare cards, we're moving to the cards, that there is a broader area, particularly for people on bus, to be able to have access to Smart Trip cards just in general, that hopefully will mitigate the current situation, which is a real need for people to be able to add money on these buses, because they don't have anywhere else they can do it. So I'm very concerned about that, and would definitely want to look very closely at that before we would try to implement something like that. Thank you.
I think we will need a further discussion of this in the coming months. It's obviously a matter of concern, a major impact on our customers, and I haven't yet seen a good indication of exactly what the benefits will be and how much it improves service for others. So I'd like to hear more about it as well. Cliff.
Thank you, Mort. Two quick questions on the operating budget. Am I right to assume that the restoration of the federal transit benefit isn't reflected in our revenue?
That's correct.
Okay. And then secondly, on the expense side, last spring we talked about WMATA developing a five-year forecast of operating expenses. I thought there was a commitment made at that point that that was a good idea. I know that Paul and myself were used to that that business practice in the great state of Maryland. So I wonder if you guys could provide us an update on when that will be developed, and if you can't do it, explain why you're not going to do that. I think Tony had asked a lot of questions about why we can't forecast our operating expenses beyond 12 months as well. So I think it's not just something isolated to the District of Columbia.
So thank you, Lee. When that commitment was, the questions were raised, as you recall, we provided actually a 10-year outlook
respect, which was discussed with the board, which again is the basis for the FY17 proposal. The expectation is that once the board establishes the FY17 baseline, then that will be used as a basis for projecting the 5 years. I mean, we can do it 5 years now, but if the board changes any of the underlying components, then that changes the remaining four-year outlook. But once, by April, if we get a sense that, yes, that's what the board is going to approve, we will certainly do that as part of the submission.
Ms. Porter?
I wonder, as in addition to the other things that we've been talking about, for things that we could get at a later date, if you could give us a new estimate of the point, and I believe Mr. Downey referred to it as the catch-up point, the point at which we are finished with the big rehab and we're into sort of steady-state regular maintenance. I think we had been projecting that was going to be 2017 or 2018, and I'm sure it's later than that now. But it seems to me that's a really, I mean, I very much like the film, but I think it's also important for people to sort of know that there's an end point to sort of the very intensive project, you know, updates, rehab that we've been doing. So that would be helpful also.
Okay, thanks. Gracias.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to note about the fare on bus adding, that we really need to expand and look to other areas as well. I have some concern about it also, but I also recognize the limitations. I'm sitting next to a VRE board member, I think, and they have an electronic piece on VRE. But more importantly, we hear that other transit projects along the area are using libraries. So the most important thing is, where can we put them, where people are? What are their natural places that they go? And I think we can go jurisdictionally and kind of look at that and ask ourselves what we can do. And that will change the dynamic of what those folks' lives are like. The electronic is a little bit different. It spans everybody, but that's not going to be the population too often that we're going to be able to hit. But the libraries and places where people will go. And we had a notice of a transit property just recently regarding how they've done that. And it is being done in other areas as well.
Okay. I'll come back, Mike, to the max fare issue. I just had a couple of other basic questions. I wanted to be sure I understood the answer to Leif's question on the transit benefit. We saw your budget proposal in December. At that time, the transit benefit had not been reenacted.
That's correct.
But did you say you assumed it would be, or?
No.
No, so we're.
It is not part
right,
of the.
It is not reflected in the budget that's here. To the extent that will improve our ridership, that's upside risk.
That's correct.
Good. On the downside risk, the operating budget presumes finding $20 million through the efficiency study, but that is not something that's been nailed down. Before we enact the budget in May, I think we need to know exactly where that money will be found. I don't
Absolutely.
Think we can adopt a budget with a hope about the future. I know other people do that, but they have the ability to print money. On the preventive maintenance, I expressed this at the last meeting. I will express it again. I do have long-term concern about putting more and more of our limited capital funds into the operating budget, replacing things that always were paid in the operating budget. It really is reducing our ability to reinvest in the system. And I note in the write-up associated with the slides, the comment that if we do continue to do this, the jurisdictions may have to look more closely at the amount of capital contribution they can bring in, or else we would have to truly cut our capital program. So I don't want to think this is something that is pain-free or risk-free. I also would like a little further information. Your presentation states that FTA is recommending this. I want to differentiate. A, they may be recommending that it's useful to them to see our activities paid for with their funding, because they then have some control over it. I don't think they are encouraging greater use of preventive maintenance.
as a budgeting tool. And I'd just like to get clarity. I don't need it now, but I'd like to get clarity on just what FTA is suggesting. And then they want to have conversations with them about that suggestion. And just
they suddenly have encouraged the use of their funds for preventive maintenance activities.
Yeah, because they have visibility on it, correct, and they will know we're doing it. But I'm not.
Which is,
I differentiate that from them saying this is a good idea.
No, we use the word encourage, which is what they've told us.
And lastly, on the multi-year approach, which really will not be affected this year, I agree that this is not the year to try to get the multiple-year commitment out of the region, but we are talking about the 1 year in that context. I believe what you said is the additional federal money that is coming now as a result of the FAST Act will be used to reduce the amount of borrowing long term, not to increase the program, but that's a benefit. And also note that the PREA funds are not fully authorized for this 6 year period, and we need to reflect that and begin to work on how that happens. Any other? Yes, Tony.
Before you go, Michael.
Yeah.
Transit subsidy impact. We should see both revenue and ridership increases starting this year.
Yes.
And built into the 17 budget proposal. So it's not in there now. Are you adjusting to reflect a projection?
We will do that. Just to remind of the timeline, this budget was presented before.
No, I know why it's not. I'm just asking when it will be.
We expect to adjust because the chairman just mentioned there are several issues that are still up in the air, and the expectation would be to adjust for the capital, to adjust on the operating budget, and then to provide to the general manager alternatives to this board in new set of numbers.
Okay.
So we'll see the positive effect of that before we have to bite the bullet on other things.
Perhaps be conservative with that number, because we have gone a little far in estimating the impact of that on our ridership.
Mr. Chairman, but I assume you're tracking now day by day and month by month what the effect has been. And are those people who were only riding the first 15 days because their benefit ran out, or are we going to see them for the whole 30 days? We should know that fairly soon.
Just a matter of have we been able to correct the transit benefit for January, the month we're in, administratively, because it takes a while to do these benefits? Are we going to lose January and maybe February?
DOT runs it for a lot of the agencies.
So we may lose January, and can we reset the benefit for February in an efficient way? I don't know. We need to. I know it's on their side, but this happens so late in the year that when you sign up for like dental insurance or any benefit, it takes a while for the system to make the correction. So it could be a 2 month loss.
Tony, do you have insight into that?
It's just a clarification, Tom, on
losing.
It's an agency by agency decision as to whether they have money to actually up their limit.
I know.
In real time.
Oh,
so
they have a legal obligation to do it.
Not increase their.
Really? They have to pay whatever.
And so one thing we might want to talk about and can help on our end is to talk to federal agencies, agency by agency, to understand what their proposal is to increase.
I thought, Tony, that TransServe, which is in the Department of Transportation, was the key sub-agency for the federal employees.
They administer the program, but agencies have to look at their own budget to understand whether they can actually incorporate that increase.
Well, can you talk to TransServe then? Because I've given up talking to them because they don't play the game very well.
I can try, and I'll give it a shot.
But federal policy in the past has been to make the full amount of the benefit available to all employees, and agencies were told to find the money to do it. I think we certainly should encourage that.
They were encouraged to find the money to do it.
Find the money to do it.
I was talking about, Mr. Chairman, I was talking about not on the federal, state, and local employees because they get a subsidy because they don't pay federal tax. I was talking about employers who do the pre-tax benefit because that's a reset that is hard for the, it's harder for them to make that reset from 130 a month to 255 a month. So that's the challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to move an authorization for the staff to include in the FY17 budget a proposal that I discussed at the December meeting, and that would be that we do a four-month pilot program reducing the maximum fare for long-haul riders from $5.90 to $5. That pilot program, that experiment, would run from September 2017 through the end of December 2017, and the idea would be to test if a reduction in the long-haul fare can bring riders back to a metro, get them off of the roads, get them off of wherever they are, and get them back onto metro. The reason I make that proposal is because we have now one of the highest subway fares in the country at $5.90 maximum one way. By comparison, New York City has a fare $2.75. You can go anywhere on the city, $2.75. You can go from the Bronx, Yankee Stadium, to Coney Island on $2.75. On the other hand, we've seen ridership decline by 5% over the last 5-6 years, and that ridership decline, according to our efficiency study experts, McKinsey, is greater in the stations beyond the Beltway, seemingly signaling that we have a problem with long-haul ridership, and that's not surprising considering the size of the current fare, the decline in gas prices, and other factors in the regional economy. So the proposal is to limit this to a four-month period to test the hypothesis that if we cut the fares by 90 cents each way, with roughly 10 to 15%, we can actually stimulate enough new long-haul riders to change the curve and increase ridership on our system. Now, as Dennis pointed out, Metro relies on a study that was done by the University of Maryland in terms of elasticity. And that elasticity study would suggest that a 10% fare decrease would only produce a 1.5% increase in ridership. That seems entirely conservative from my point of view. That may work on the other way as a good elasticity measure for a fare increase, but I think it's worth going into the marketplace for a couple months to actually test whether that's a realistic elasticity factor as far as a fare decrease is concerned. We've limited, according to the authorization that I've drafted, we would limit the revenue exposure to $2 million, which is what the staff predicts using the Maryland elasticity model, would be the downside in terms of revenue, and we'd actually lose some revenue, roughly about $2 million over a four-month period, and we've capped that so that if the projections turn out to be worse than anticipated, they can curtail the program, curtail the test in the fourth month, December, so that the exposure is at most $2 million. And for a operating budget of close to $1.7, $1.8 billion, that reflects about 1.2% of the operating budget. That seems to me a pretty good bet, risk to take if we can encourage people, long-haul riders, to come back to Metro, get them off of 66, get them back, get them off of the toll road, get them off of 270, and get them onto the Red Line and get them onto the Silver Line. So I would propose that we move forward with that kind of authorization so that that can be included in the 2017 budget that the staff is developing over the next couple months. Thank you.
And you're making that as a motion?
I am.
Yeah. Before we discuss, is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Yes.
Sure. So I'll play this for a few months. I'm the new guy, so I have a question. That downside risk is not to WMATA, it's really to the jurisdictions, because we have to make up the shortfall from the max fare. So
that's right.
You're essentially shifting costs from users to the general population.
In the worst case scenario, if passengers didn't respond to the fare decrease, And if the only response was the small increase, the 1.5% projected by the staff's elasticity factor, yes, then we would hit a $2 million deficiency that the jurisdictions would have to make up. If passengers reacted, riders reacted to the proposal, that would reduce the amount of hit for the jurisdictions. It might wipe it out entirely. We may get a situation where we ended up with the same amount of revenue and more ridership to boot. So that's the upside of the proposal.
But that would be a scenario not supported by at least the elasticity study.
That's correct.
So, okay.
Yes, Kathy and then Jim.
Mr. Goldman, you started out making a comparison when you introduced this, and you introduced other transit properties that have much lower fares. And I would ascribe that we could have much lower fares, too, if we all jurisdictionally contributed more or if we had a dedicated source of revenue. And we have not a dedicated source of revenue. And we all are anxious, and we've just decided to delay a capital budget long term. And I can point to different things. So I don't think we can have it both ways. We have to understand. As noted, jurisdictions pick up the balance of what the max fare is as it is. But we have all of the other things that we point to that we do for the customer or we do for those jurisdictionals. I would be concerned greatly, as you are, for that Largo customer coming to the full length of the Silver Line. But I also recognize that there is, in other places, there isn't someone getting off the hook on that side. So I would really like to look at the data. And I had another point. I think there is a risk when we do pilots that are that short on fares. I think it's a kind of uncertainty that you build in. And I'd really like to rely upon the data and understand the data a little bit more and think of how other ways we can help those passengers with a different type of service delivery, because I'm not comfortable saying that reducing it by 90 cents and then we pick up the differences and we're going to go back to the customer and decide whether the jurisdictions will be happy with that or how we're going to address that response. You've worked the numbers as to where your proposal works for you. The question is, how does it work for the rest of us? That's it.
Mr. Goldman, Mike, being a marketing-based person, I do like the idea of trying to increase ridership, and I do look at the opportunities to do that because we have fixed costs in running these trains, and if we can increase the overall revenue, it would be a good thing. One of the concerns I have, and we've talked about the transportation subsidy being reinstituted, is that we are going to see net reduced fares for riders across the system, both long-term, long-haul, and short-haul. And if we do, and while not opposed to supporting the test, I think we need to be sure that we can isolate the results as to where it's coming from. And I believe, as Mr. Bolger has talked about, there's going to be a build in getting folks onto the subsidy program again. Don't know if we can actually isolate that, so I think we need to proceed with caution with the results that we may see from that, but certainly open to testing it, but want to make sure that we can determine what the results are attributable to.
Yeah, I think on the subsidy program, the benefit program, most of the beneficiaries of that increase will be the long-distance riders. You have to required to pay a fairly high fare in order to be able to draw down the full benefit. So if it's put in, yes, I'm sorry. Yes, right, yes, right. Call it a benefit. But it also has to be a benefit that our federal agencies are ready to give to their employees. So we'll see about that. Other questions? Yes.
Paul. Thank you, Mr. Denny. Not only, Mr. Goldman, looking at the results, but also how we are going to, analyze them. What is the base in which we're going to consider this pilot a success? I'm a little concerned about the time, 4 months does seem a little short, particularly, you know, is it just break even? Is that success? Or is it, you know, adding ridership and making additional funds available for the system? I'm also concerned how this is presented at a time when, you know, in my jurisdiction and in other, Arlington and others, where blue line people are standing on platforms with extended headways, all the capital needs that we have, maintenance needs, safety issues. So I, you know, I think that's another consideration that we have to, you know, look at, for this. And also, I'd be curious. I don't need it now, but is there a breakdown by jurisdiction of, how riders across the system are potentially, benefit from this program?
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would think also for the folks politically would maybe have a difficult time justifying if this did not work, having to explain to their constituents that they made participated in a decision that created an implicit tax down the road. But that's not even the real big concern. It's also going to be very difficult, even if this is not successful, to roll it, to take it away. It's a benefit that people who benefit from it will come to love and really become attached to. And if at some point we say, well, it didn't achieve our ultimate goals, we're going to raise the prices on you, that's also going to have a backlash. So I just think we need to think about all of these things in terms of crafting what's the best way to get at what are your very good intentions of trying to reward people who are committed to the system and really try to encourage more. Just not sure this exactly gets there.
I would also say that we do want to be innovative. We do want to look at ways to make the system more affordable. The board has asked the staff to do that. I mean, Ms. Porter reminded me of that when we were talking about the pilots and stuff like that, to be careful not to imply that we are not looking to staff to look at innovative ways to increase our riders, and they've responded. So we actually have on tap where they're going to work on a couple of those things that has come from them, and I think that we should be careful not to, at the same time, kind of overdo it. I mean, we've got this that they're working on, that they're going to bring forward. Let's work that one, I think, see how that works, the past works, if it functions. We've got a great planning staff, too. I would also say that they are world-class and renowned. And these are some of the things that they've worked up, worked through, they've recommended to us, and I think we should go with them. Thank you.
Other comments? Just one question. Ms. Golden made the comparison to New York, which is fundamentally a subway system. Our system is more of a hybrid, subway, commuter rail. I'd be interested in seeing a comparison of typical commuter rail systems, fares for trips of this length. $5.90 is probably a pretty cheap fare compared to what someone on the Long Island Railroad would be paying, even perhaps what people on VRE are paying. Metro North, whatever. Yeah.
I don't have an answer to that, Mr. Chairman. I do want to respond to a couple of thoughts. One criticism was that, well, we have the transit benefit coming into place. And these are not going to happen at the same time. We're going to get a good deal of experience with the transit benefit between now and through all of FY16. So this is a test that I'm proposing, which is not going to start till FY17, and it's not going to start at the beginning of FY17 in July 1. It's going to start September 1 when people come back from school, when people come back from vacations. So I think we're going to have enough experience with the transit benefit to be able to develop a fair base period at that time. Second of all, then there was criticism, well, it's going to be too short, and people are going to be feeling it's an entitlement. Well, we voted last month to go forward with an authorization for this name-your-own-fare pilot. And I think the same criticisms can be made of that, that to the extent that we're creating some benefit for people, people are going to have an entitlement, and that's going to become permanent. So to the extent that we're concerned about pilots becoming permanent, we ought to apply that consistently across the board. And second, in terms of, third, in terms of risk for jurisdiction, let's realize this is really small potatoes. This is a $1.8 billion operating budget. We're talking about, at most, a risk of $2 million, which is 1.2% of the total operating budget. That's not a lot of what we're in charge with as governing. On the other hand, let's look at the potential benefits. You know, we've got a system that's been losing ridership, been losing revenue for the last 5 or 6 years. We need to do something. That's not sustainable. We need to fill up rail cars. And if we don't fill up rail cars, in a year or two, we're going to be faced with an even bigger crisis of people saying, well, then, if you can't fill rail cars, you ought to take the rail cars off the line or you ought to cut service. So I think we should be doing as many things as we can be doing now to reverse that decline, make it an increase, get people back riding on our subway system, get people back riding on our commuter rail system, whatever you call it. And at a very minimal cost, we can at least find out in the real world whether reducing fares has any real benefit, whether it really brings people back to the system. And so that's the nature of the pilot and the experiment, the test that I'm proposing with this authorization.
Any other comments? No, we'll proceed to vote. Those in favor, please indicate by raising their hand. Got the count on that? Those opposed? The motion, if I count correct, did not carry.
It did not carry.
It failed. And I think that's the end of the business for the Finance Committee.